Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to look today into the 1960s, and it's very important with the 60s, and particularly with the Vietnam War, which tends to dominate a lot of the discussion of geopolitics in application, as it were. It's very important to remember that to contemporaries, the 60s took place against the background of and in the context of the 1950s, which in turn was contextualized by World War II and its immediate aftermath. So although we might be looking from the 60s for developments that lasted much longer, most obviously the Sino-Soviet split, which helped to define global strategic options till the 2000s, when those two powers, by then Russia and China, moved closer together, we have to be aware that that was not the perspective that people had at the time. Now, I've already mentioned from last time the domino theory or the domino effect, which President Eisenhower enunciated in a press conference on the 7th of April, 1954. And we tend to obviously think about that, as indeed Eisenhower did when he enunciated the theory in the aftermath of French failure at Dien Bien Phu in Southeast Asia. We tend to think about it primarily in terms of Vietnam, and we're going to come to discuss that and Vietnam in the 60s. But it's worth bearing in mind that one of the reasons why the domino theory or the domino effect, both of those terms were used by contemporaries, one of the reasons why that had such an impact was precisely because the image, and it's an image more than a theory, the image could be more widely applied. Indeed, it could be universally applied. You could say about just about anything. If we yield over this or fail over that, then the following consequences will flow, and those consequences we can catastrophize either because they do appear catastrophic or indeed because they might be catastrophic. So for example, the theory lay behind American-backed intervention in Cuba in 1961, and in the Bay of Pigs episode in which Cuban exiles were supported informally by the Americans, because it was feared that Cuba would be the basis for the spread of Soviet influence in Latin America. And this, which in a sense would undermine if you want to call it a geopolitics of American hemispheric confidence, security, policy that went back to the early 19th century. This intervention and its total defeat at the Bay of Pigs was also an instance of what we've already discussed in terms of rollback, and indeed a warning about the vulnerability of rollback. But again, reminding us that you can look at any instance in more than one light, which of course always undermines the glibness of so many remarks about geopolitics and much else. There was, on the American part, a failure to provide sufficient force, notably air cover, to this end. Now, you might argue that if they had provided air cover, the exiles would have landed safely, but that doesn't mean that they would necessarily have overthrown the Castro regime, which was a very different task. And indeed, arguing from Castro's success with modest force in overthrowing earlier the Batista regime does not demonstrate that the same could have been done against Castro. Doesn't demonstrate it couldn't, doesn't demonstrate it could, which again reminds us of the need to be flexible, to think of geopolitics in terms of possibilism, not in terms of determinism. In other words, what just that very brief mention of Cuba in 61 shows us is we underline the essentially politicized nature of the discussion of geopolitics and the difficulty of applying concepts without such politicization. Because as listeners will be aware, the argument that the exiles failed because They weren't provided by the air cover, was used by critics of Kennedy, possibly even by conspiratorial critics of Kennedy, and it cannot, as it were, be removed from that political context. Could not readily be removed, I think I should say. The domino effect was also offered in support of Western commitments in the Mediterranean and the Middle East. For example, American troops were sent to Lebanon in 1958 in response to the Eisenhower Doctrine announced in 57, in which America promised aid against the spread of communism, indeed the very one we've already mentioned. Already in 57, assistance had accordingly been provided to Jordan, although in that case, the doctrine wasn't formally advanced. The American deployment in 58 was instrumental to the end of the Lebanon crisis of that year and reflects a very different political context, both internationally and in Lebanon, and indeed more generally in the Middle East, to the context today in 2023. And indeed, a very different nature of a force capability on both parts. The British deployment of forces to Jordan the same year was part of the identical anti-Egyptian stance and was followed by British military support for Kuwait against Iraqi expansion into claims in 61. So these interventions were both responses to crises in particular countries, and they were designed to prevent a sequential collapse of pro-Western governments. In 58, there was the overthrow of the pro-Western monarchy in Iraq, and that caused alarm, as well as, in fact, helping to harm the anti-Soviet geopolitics of bases, because there'd been air bases have been used in northern Iraq in the planning for war, include air war, including nuclear war against the Soviet Union. So the specific now was Iraq had been monarchy had been overthrown by a Ba'athist rising. This then appeared to threaten British interests in the Gulf and American interests more generally in the Middle East and more widely. That then ensured that you need a response. Now, you can call that geopolitics if you like. You can also call it just plain common sense, or you can call it the complex nature in which you cast around for explanations for what appears to be intuitively correct. At any rate, Kuwait was seen as the forward place for the Gulf. In practice, as I've already indicated, geopolitical linkages are complex, and they were complex. So, as a prime instance of the complex nature of outcomes, the Vietnam War, which we're going to be discussing, indeed led to the communist takeover of South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia in the mid-1970s, but not as had initially and during most of the conflict being feared, those of Thailand or Malaysia. At a different level, that of priorities, in 1965-66, during the Vietnam War, America had supported the military overthrow of the left-leaning nationalist government of Indonesia. And that was, Indonesia was being the setting for the non-aligned 1955 Asia-Africa Conference in Bandung. The Indonesia had appeared to be a state, it's the most populous state in the world, as well as incidentally being one in which has significant oil reserves in both Borneo and Sumatra. Indonesia had been moving less leftwards. What the military overthrow in 65-66 ensured, and you can emphasize both American intervention and the autonomous nature of the political development within Indonesia, in favor of the overthrow, what this illustrated is where you should place your priorities. Because in one sense, we go on talking about the Vietnam War, but in comparison to what happened in Indonesia, the Vietnam War was relatively inconsequential. Certainly, what was provided, what the West was provided with as a result of Indonesia, was with a strategic depth for Southeast Asia. And the geopolitical and military and every other consequences, therefore, of defeat in the Vietnam War at the strategic level were lessened greatly. Not that that helped those people who were killed, injured, or had their lives totally disrupted. Now, the extent to which this transition can be readily conceptualized in terms of a movement or thickening of the rimland, as in the classic geopolitical ideas, or the periphery, if you wish to use that term, is more instructive about the difficulties of applying geopolitical ideas. At the same time, the relative ease with which Indonesia, moved between, as it were, the East and the West, posed a question mark about the idea of two coherent blocks, and also the nature of the Cold War as, in some way, almost a geographically fixed and coherent situation. Moreover, as another instance of the same, the Vietnam War was soon followed by Vietnam at war with China and with its protégés in Cambodia. This war began with rivalry with the protégés, which in turn led to a full-scale Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia in 1978, to which China replied in 1979 by attacking Vietnam. As in the case of so many geopolitical analyses, it is possible to present this crisis in two lights. One involved China trying to prevent encirclement by the Soviet Union and its Vietnamese protege. In other words, you can use that as an explanation for the Chinese attack on Vietnam in 79. So that's one way of looking at it geopolitically. In other words, we try and stop encirclement. In the other way, you could argue it's China trying to anchor American support by presenting itself as a clear opponent of the Soviet Union. Indeed, one could argue, and my own view is that both are pertinent, but one could argue that what this demonstrated was the flexibility, indeed, plasticity of geopolitics, which had already been shown by the Sino-Soviet split and its consequences. So let's wind back a second. We were talking the previous week about a geopolitics defined by containment of communism. We were talking about Kennan, we were talking about the response to the communist takeover in China and to the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950. But what we actually see in the 1960s is that this apparent clarity was misleading. And indeed, in part, the Vietnam War had provided China and the Soviet Union with the opportunity to pursue and test their rivalry, alongside, as a different issue, weakening America, or at least committing its forces to what was a diversion as far as China and even more the Soviet Union was concerned. And it's worth bearing in mind that if you're looking at the present day, much of the discussion of prioritization, particularly for the United States, between Ukraine, the Middle East, Taiwan, reflects similar factors. It doesn't mean that they're identical. One should never apply history as if it's some clear-cut lesson, but it does mean that one can see the very flexibility of geopolitics in practice in the past, and the instance we're talking about is the 60s and 70s, and can think through what the implications, or should think through what the implications of that are for the present moment. Now, such diversionary consequences, and we've got diversionary consequences potentially now from China's point of view, if it's geopolitical drive is to take Taiwan, as does appear likely under Xi, then obviously the diversion of American attention, military resources, political will, both domestic and internationally, towards Ukraine and or the Middle East, with the latter rising in prominence at the moment, is a success for China, however much it might or might not have been having agency in what is going on. Anyway, such diversionary consequences, both then and now, prove difficult to translate to geopolitical models, as the latter, notably that of containment, offer little in the form of prioritization between tasks and opportunities. And if you think about that, you can see, for example, in the British case, the way in which there was debate about the latest strategic review and about whether the emphasis in it on a global Britain, particularly naval power projection, was or was not vitiated by the Russian move into Ukraine. And that caused controversy at the time, particularly by protagonists of the, for a larger army. And it led to calls for the revision of the strategic document. You have the same thing at the present moment with American politicians and the American public confronting differing pressures in terms of prioritization. So it's a little unclear how any particular theory, if you wish to call it a theory, can be used in this case. And this reminds us of the extent to which the idea that international relations is a branch of a social science that has a similar, as it were, rules-based system of analysis to those of the physical sciences, such as physics, is questionable, which is being polite or looked at differently, it can be argued that the very notion of a science is less precise than its vocabulary might suggest. Indeed, prioritization becomes central to any debate that surrounds the application of models, however scientific they may appear to be. The debate often sounds more coherent than debates. For in practice, the habit of contesting priorities and ideas is far from formalized. Again, debate pushes politics to the fore. Moreover, models say little about the psychological elements that play such a significant role in deciding where to make commitments and to what extent. So, an instance in the case of the Kennedy administration, which, just to remind people, is 1961 to 63, was the Catholic anti-communism that influenced President Kennedy, notably in the cases of Cuba and Vietnam. This Catholic anti-communism was a potent, multifaceted ideological continuum that operated in many contexts from interwar Europe to Poland in the 1980s. And it doesn't fit well into social scientific modelling based on a competitive state system, because those tend to downplay ideological factors. Now, once we're talking about, let us say, you know, international Catholicism, then geopolitics is a part of the total history of the age and lacks a single trajectory. It's certainly true that the Soviet Union sought a single trajectory. The Soviet Union saw itself as at the revolutionary forefront, but in fact, it found itself unable to control the course of developments. And this was latent from the onset in the tension between the unidirectional party philosophy and practice and the frictions offered by a variety of circumstances and by the moves of others. And you can see this in other respects. You could see it in the non-aligned movement. You can see it in pan-Arabism, both then and indeed one might argue in the present day, that it's very easy to use the rhetoric of a certain policy, but in often associated with a geographical space, but in practice, the application of it would reveal serious differences. So, you know, let us take the present crisis, and people will have differing views, but I just want to illustrate what I'm talking about. You can, if you're a pan-Arabist, talk about trying to destroy Israel and whatever you might mean by free Palestine. But the practicality is, as already was seen in the Gaza Strip, where Hamas, in order to take over, displaced and killed Fatah operatives, the practicality would be that it would not only be Israelis, both Jews and non-Jews, who were slaughtered, pushed out, whatever, but this would also almost certainly lead to civil conflict between Palestinians, however defined. Again, that is a point that's worth thinking about with Pan-Arabism. Pan-Arabism, which was particularly earlier backed by President Nasser, the dictator of Egypt, proved in many senses a matter of Egyptian expansionism and would-be control in Yemen, in Syria, intervention would be in Iraq, intervention in Libya, attempts to dominate Sudan, as much as it had anything to do with whatever you might mean by a philosophy of Pan-Arabism. So one has to use these ideas with caution. Returning to the Vietnam War, there was a geostrategic mismatch there. The Soviet Union provided aid to the North Vietnamese, notably surface-to-air missiles, which increased the risk and cost of using American air power, but both were modest compared to the American commitment. And that, again, is instructive for the modern age, that disruptive powers can, at a relatively modest cost to themselves, often cause immense problems for those seeking to contain them. One can think about some of the instances of the use by Iran of, you know, which is fairly costly, but less costly than if it was to deploy its forces in full, of surrogates in the Middle East. Convenience played a role with the Vietnam War. And to that extent, I think one can very much see a geographical example. The Americans could intervene in Vietnam, which after all had a very long coastline, but they couldn't in inland Laos, which had been central to an international crisis in 62, when America opposed communist advance. Inland states, of course, could attract American intervention, as did Afghanistan from 2001, but could also enjoy a measure of protection, as with the Serbian position in Kosovo in 1999. In the case of the Kosovo crisis, the Americans were insistent that air power was all that they could reasonably provide, and indeed the Greek reluctance to see their current country served as a transit point for NATO intervention in Kosovo underlined the problems of dealing with such internal instances. In South Vietnam, moreover, the Americans benefited from the major cities being on or near the coast. Ports provided a transoceanic lift in capacity that air power could not. At the same time, aircraft carriers could offer air power that was closer than distant land bases in, for example, Guam and Thailand. This meant that it was easier to replace fuel and weapons loads more rapidly. More generally, carriers offered a different geopolitics, one free of concerns about adequate air bases, overflight rights, and maintenance. Now, you can see that with the deployment of American aircraft carriers into the Eastern Mediterranean at the present moment and American anti-missile cruisers in the Red Sea. Aerial refueling also extended range in a way that changed geopolitical considerations based on simple measures of range. In other words, you know, drawing lines on maps became somewhat less relevant if you could refuel aircraft in significant numbers, and we have to underline the scale element in the air. For political reasons, America could not attack the effective industrial capacity of North Vietnam, because that effective industrial capacity was in many respects located in China and the Soviet Union. But the commitment to Vietnam was pushed to the fore in order to show, that's the American commitment, that America could, would, and therefore must act and would not be dissuaded by the difficulties of the task. The use of the conflict as a proxy war and diversionary power by the communist great powers being an instance of that, domestic and international criticism being another instance of this difficulty, and the search for a possible political settlement being a third. So you could argue, if you wish to apply words or phrases even more flexibly, that this was a geopolitics of attitude, which indeed is a prime form of what we call geopolitics. So the American approach being that the difficulties of the task were not going to dissuade their commitment to a particular area of territory. One significant aspect of the situation was the American refusal to accept the degree to which, in practice, in the Vietnam War, they shared the space and the initiative with their opponents, and did so in a fashion that varied across Vietnam, with physical and human geographies both playing a role, as it had done in previous conflicts and does in conflicts since. Indeed, this is a classic instance of conflict as geopolitics, with the latter understood as being a matter not simply of here is Vietnam, but let us differentiate, or any other country, Ukraine, but let us differentiate Vietnam or Ukraine with reference to the human and physical geography on the spot, and indeed also the congruence across continuous land frontiers. Secondly, on a model used elsewhere, as in China, there was a determination by the communists to use violence in order to win social control, weakening opponents by the assassination of their leaders and other measures of intimidation that ensured that the government forces operated in effect in what was a vacuum, which of course is a problem for the Israelis in the Gaza Strip. This was a geopolitics of the localities, one common to insurgencies, in which there was a determination to force the government troops back to their bases and thus create a secure basis for the operation of the insurgents. And classic geo-guerrilla theory, as enunciated, for example, though he was far less original than he might like to think, but Mao Zedong in the 30s, classic insurgency theory argues in favor of this geopolitics of limited effective control by state forces, and therefore the creation of a situation within a state or within a country, whatever term you wish to use, in which the insurgents also have agency from a secure base. This sharing came to the fore with the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Tet Offensive of early 68, a surprise assault that was designed to further limit the extent to which there was a safe base for government forces. Interestingly enough, again, that demonstrates the role of attitudes. However misleading, because the Tet Offensive was defeated, but, however misleadingly, the offensive contributed greatly within America, as well as in its alliance system, and more widely, to a sense of crisis in the American world order, a crisis that suggested that America was losing the Cold War and certainly the initiative. Given the significance of impressions to willpower, in this case to the degree to which we're talking about a field of battle, success in particular engagements, notably the contested city of Hue, had clear political consequences. And again, the analogy with the present situation is interesting. And I mean, much worse than that for the people involved, of course. The sense that Hamas, with its act of terrorism, has greatly created a sense of weakness on the part of Israel, which Israel then has to demonstrate the mistaken character of by seriously weakening Hamas. And, you know, the analogy is by no means precise or exact, but it's worth thinking about. And again, it's worth thinking about what one means about success in this context. We're not talking about the brutal nature of the terrorism. What one's talking about is the impressions created among both one's alliance system, so in the case of Hamas, accumulating more funds from Iran, but also among those who might or might not be sympathizers, a state like Turkey, for example. So also, to at least in degree, in the case of the Vietnam War, with the American air attack on North Vietnam. Again, there was a fusion of place and policy, creating a geopolitics that was turned into a strategy. American policymakers seeking to contain the struggle were reluctant to pursue the open targeting of an all-out sub-nuclear assault, which constrains whatever you might mean by the geopolitics of air power. Instead, there was a belief that they could use a graduated process of air attack in order to send clear messages. Well, that didn't work out well. The large-scale American use of aircraft indeed represented an attempt to apply power across a geographical distance, but of course without the same equation of success operating for each side. So each side could imagine that they were acquiring success on the one hand by delivering ordnance and destroying targets, and on the other hand by continuing to fight on and preserve resolve, and indeed to a great extent repairing damage. And yet each could believe that they were masters of the geopolitics of the situation. At the same time, as I've already mentioned, global geopolitics was being totally reshaped by Sino-Soviet struggles. Focusing on what he called the Third World, itself a geopolitical term, Mao Zedong claimed that the real division was between North and South, not West and East, and argued that the Soviet project was like that of the Western powers, that they both pursued imperialism, whereas, of course, he wasn't pursuing imperialism in, for example, Tibet. Border conflict in 1969 made the rift readily apparent and thereby altered global geopolitics for all powers. This greatly complicated the theme of civilizational or at least essential struggle between communist and non-communist blocs. And I think we can pause then there, Graham, and discuss Vietnam before moving on to take that last point further forward in the next programme.
Well, I think, Jeremy, that is a good moment to pause. I want to just go back to the beginning for a moment and talk a little bit more the context of the domino theory. Domino theory, is it something that arrives in geopolitics as a fully formed idea, or does it have a mission creep? So does it, for example, draw inspiration from the defense of Malaya from Chinese insurgency there, the emergency there, and take the view, well, this can be done, so it should be done. If the British can do it in Malaya, then the Americans can do it wherever else in Southeast Asia is called to. Or does it start really with, well, Thailand is an essential a friendly power in the region, it starts there, but then actually it's important that the countries that border Thailand are protected from the advance of communism as well. Is it a sweeping idea, or is it a fully formed dogma?
Ooh. I think it's fair to say it's an image. I mean, I would use it as an image. I mean, and I quoted last time from Eisenhower's press conference on the 7th of April, 54, in which he said, you have broader considerations that might follow what you would call the falling domino principle. You have a row of dominoes set up, you knock over the first one, And what will happen to the last one is the certainty that it will go over very quickly. So you could have the beginning of a disintegration that would have the most profound influences. And he cited the loss of Indochina, of Burma, Thailand, Malaya, and Indonesia. Now, I suppose you could say that they had seen this in practice with German expansionism in 39-41 in Europe, with Japanese expansionism in 41-42, and with Soviet expansionism in Eastern Europe in the late 40s. So in a way, it was an easy image to understand. It was based upon the idea that territories are essentially approached by land, and that in order to take a control of a territory in a distance, you need to have the territory closer to it. So if you're looking at Southeast Asia, it is argued that one of the reasons why the communists failed in the Malaya emergency was that the country to the north, Thailand, was under pro-Western control. I mean, obviously, there are lots of other factors, the ethnicity one, that the communism was really based on the Chinese minority, not the Malay majority. Correspondingly, when the communists took over China in 49, which meant southern China in that particular context, that then made the Viet Minh, the left-wing nationalists in the northern part of Vietnam under Ho Chi Minh, gave them a frontier across which they could receive considerable quantities of munitions and materiel, including the anti-aircraft guns that shot down French planes trying to relieve the isolated garrison at Dien Bien Phu. So to this extent, clearly a domino theory is highly pertinent. But you see, take Cuba, which we've discussed. The success there of left-wing insurgents was one that was achieved without anything nearby becoming, as it were, already earlier of that type. And the Soviet Union is able to expand its influence without, as it were, first becoming the power in Haiti or the Dominican Republic, Jamaica or whatever. So I think one has to be careful. And the idea of jumping over containment was also to be seen in the movement of both Iraq and Egypt separately into a more pro-Soviet direction, because in each case, there was no contiguous link. So the domino effect actually was quite fallacious, other than what I would say in a psychological way. And that, I think, is much more interesting. That if you fail in instance A, it might weaken your morale, affect your allies, lead to a lessening of your prestige, all of which may mean that in struggle B, which is either going on at the same time or breaks out subsequently, that you are going to do less well. So to that effect, there are, instead of using the term the domino effect, we might simply talk about consequences.
One consequence that I'm wondering if Washington properly foresaw was the Sino-Soviet split at the beginning of the 1960s, which removes this kind of binary idea of, you know, that there are communist and communist allied entities, and then there are Western democratic and their allied entities as well, and it's a binary conflict between the two. Suddenly, communism starts to take different forms. That which looks to Moscow, that which looks to Beijing or Peking, as we then called it. There are lots of different communisms, which by the 70s are often fighting each other. To what extent was that foreseen, and to what extent did particularly American policy adjust accordingly?
Well, again, that's an excellent question. I mean, in a way, it should have been more obvious because they'd already had the Tito-Yugoslav split, which had undermined the communists in the Greek Civil War. And Tito, of course, had been able to maintain a sort of distance from the Soviet Union, despite Stalin's wishes. So you're absolutely right. I think it's fair to say that they didn't fully understand the nature of the Sino-Soviet split. And of course, there's a separate thing to that, that even if there's a split, you've still got to think, what does that mean in the particular context of the Vietnam War, indeed any other individual war? In other words, you might have two rival communist states or systems, but it doesn't mean that they will take necessarily their competition to the extent of undermining the struggle against you in a particular context. That was what was really interesting about the Sino-Soviet split, that it provided an opportunity to, as it were, weaken the international cause of communism, rather than remaining one that was ideological and political, but not military and strategic, which is what actually happened. And I think it's fair to say that it enabled the United States and its allies to do better in the second half of the Cold War at a more modest cost of mobilization of resources than would have been the case if both China and the Soviet Union had been, you know, closely aligned, and that was inadequately understood. I mean, some people understood it, but it was inadequately understood in the decades after the Cold War, and it helped to cause the strategic deterioration of the last two decades, which was due not so much to the stupidity of the commitments in Afghanistan and Iraq, but rather to the failure to, as it were, however you would have tried to do it in terms of blandishments, influence, doing deals, but the failure to prevent closer relations between China and Russia, which is the situation we find ourselves in at the present moment.
Well, that's a punchy point on which to end on. We'll pick up in the next episode in the ruins of America's policy in Vietnam and all that flows from that. But for now, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.